Hey guys, and welcome to the HYM podcast.
Yeah, welcome back to another episode. I think this is going to be like episode 12, 11 when it comes out. But yeah, another one in the bag for the boys. We're in the double digits now. So how are you doing, Jake? Where are you at the minute?
Oh, mate, I'm in the lovely town of Ludwigsburg in Germany. I'm on the sim doing F3 prep for the Mercedes boys. So yeah, just been on the sim all day today. So love that.
Good, good. And Nick, where are you? I've heard you've been doing my pro life of cycling. So where are you at the minute?
Yeah, at the moment, I'm actually in a little town called Rosenheim, which is south of Munich, staying luckily with a teammate of mine, Martin Tomczuk, before our race season starts. Yeah, actually this weekend. So yeah, been doing a bit of cycling and enjoying it over here, mate.
Good, good. No, so living that pro cyclist life as I was earlier in the year, but
I'm still talking about that.
Well, yeah, you got to reminisce, haven't you? But I'm back here in the UK and the weather has just turned nasty. So that's not brilliant. But Jake, who have we got on the show today?
Yeah, we've got somebody who is a Alpine Formula One junior driver. He's a rookie in his Formula Two season this year. He's already won a race. He won the championship in Formula Three last year, which I'm very much not happy about. And he's also won the championship in Formula Renault Eurocup, I believe. What was it? B2019. So, yeah. And he's blessed us with his presence, given us a bit of his time. So it's Mr. Oscar Piastri. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
Whereabouts are you right now? You're in Oxford, aren't you?
Yeah. So in Oxford in the UK, just came back from the Barcelona test in F2. So just chilling out at home, or home away from home, and getting ready for Monaco, really.
Yeah, how was that? How was the testing? You had 3 days, didn't you?
Yeah, so we had 3 days. We were in struggle street for the first two, I'll be honest. And then, yeah, the last day, made some big changes and found some pace, which was nice. Our quality pace seemed a lot stronger than Bahrain, which was good. And then I think our race pace is always usually pretty good, and that seemed to be true again. So pretty solid test, obviously pretty difficult to tell what everyone else is doing, and you know, who's got 50 kilos of sandbags in and who's got negative 20 in. So we'll see when we get to Monaco, but from our end it was all good.
Premier are quite famous for sandbagging.
Yeah, yes we are. I can assure you we didn't have 1.5 seconds of sandbags in the first 2 days, but yeah, it's a pretty common Premier tradition, I have to say.
Yeah, how is the new turn 10 as well?
It's changed, it's different. Yeah, for overtaking, I think it's probably worse. Yeah, to be honest, it wouldn't have been the corner that I would have changed on the track. I would have got rid of the last chicane, as I think half of the racing paddock would have. But it's a pretty nice corner, I'd say. When the rears are going, it's pretty tricky. But yeah, it's a bit more flowing, a bit quicker than the old turn 10. But I guess we'll see in the F1 weekend if it's any good for overtaking or not now.
Well, I was out there watching the Superbike test, and for the Superbike boys, it's a lot better. And we use the final two. The proper fast double two rights at the end of the lap anyway. Now it's all been pushed back. Unfortunately, that was done after Luis Salom's death there, unfortunately. But yeah, for the Superbike boys, I think the feedback was really positive about turn 10, because now it's a faster entry, scrub off the speed at the mid and then really light it up to cut it back on your shoot up to 11. But then
it's very different in cars, though, I guess, because yeah, the braking zones are just going to be so much later and we'll actually be able to carry a load of minimum speed. So I'd say, yeah, could be beneficial for the bikes, but in a car, I think it can only be worse, because you'd rather stop start. So I think Oscar's right in the sense you get rid of that last chicane and use the last two fast speed corners, maybe, just so you can try and stay a bit closer, because that last chicane is a nightmare, particularly.
I think I think turn 10 for the bikes is definitely a big improvement. But then I think, yeah, I think for both cars and bikes, they should be using those fast rights at the end of the lap, because they've created some phenomenal racing over the years. And now seeing them back in MotoGP, back in World Superbikes, yeah, it's really, really good. But go on, Jake.
Oscar, have they also changed the the width between turn 13 and 14?
No, I don't think so.
I'll be driving the wrong track model somewhere then.
Maybe they have, I don't know. They've changed the curb in turn 13 where Galeo sort of flew and hurt his back last year. They've made that basically the same as the bus stop in Spa, where they've made it like a gradual to the sausage curb, not just the sausage curb there. But yeah, for turn 10, our braking was at like probably 75 meters. I mean, we're not racing there, so I can say, but yeah, it's probably a good 25 meters shorter than it was, maybe even more, like in a race situation. So it's kind of killed it a bit. I can understand why they did it for the bikes, because I reckon it'd definitely be better for bikes. But for us, yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, it was pretty hard to overtake a fast learner at the best of times, and that's probably one of the better, if not the only, overtaking spot sort of gone now.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder how much, and I'm not going to pry too much because you don't want to give too much away, obviously, but I wonder how much that corner will influence sort of tyre wear. Compared to, obviously, it's a bit more of a traction phase, that old turn 10, and this one's a bit more leaning on the outside right rear. So I just wonder how that's going to differ, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think at Barcelona, like, the right rear doesn't really cop too much of a beating. It's generally like the left side, so I don't think it will change that much, and it's more just a combined exit now rather than an actual traction zone. So it's a bit different, but I can't imagine it'll change the world in terms of tyre wear.
Yeah, and I guess obviously that test has come mid-season, effectively, after your first race in Bahrain, which obviously you won, I think, race two, right? You must be pretty pleased to get that out straight away. I mean, I think you won race one in F3 last year as well, so you're sort of good at getting that one off your back immediately.
Yeah, to be honest, before sort of the last safety car and switch to options and stuff, race two was probably our weakest in terms of pace. Like we were kind of nowhere and going backwards really, and then the late safety car and switch to options sort of brought us back in the mix, and then made a few good moves and we got the win. But I think as a whole the weekend was good as well. I think we did one thing right in every race, whether that was a start or overtaking of the first lap or pace or whatever. We just didn't quite get it all together. I think race three was pretty close to that until about two laps from the end, when I had a bit of a shunt. But yeah, I think it was a pretty positive first weekend, and getting that first win was good.
Do we talk about that? Whose fault was it?
I mean, I'm definitely not apportioning, you know, more blame to Dan than to myself. I think it was at least 50-50, if not more, on my side. I mean, from my perspective, I was trying to keep him and Lawson behind so I could try and get Vashore, and because he was dropping off pretty big time. So I was just trying to keep Dan behind me at all costs, and yeah, probably stuck in trying to make a move happen that, you know, wasn't really on in the end. But once I'd committed and the gap started to close, it was all over. So
I mean, I guess he was in your blind spot as well at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the thing was, he tried the lap before and I'd managed to hang on the outside. So I think my mentality was probably, all right, I'll just do it again. And his mentality was, okay, I'll make life a bit difficult for him this time. So I think it was just one of those incidents. I think no penalty was the right call. But yeah, if I had that one back, probably would have done a few things differently, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, before, we'll probably come back onto the F2 season. Obviously, you've only had one race so far. But yeah, we'd like to take it back to sort of where you got into racing, to be honest. So I think you got into karting around 2011, if I'm not mistaken.
So 2011. So I think I was 10 at that point. So sort of late, I guess, compared to some people. I know yourself, I'm pretty sure you started quite a bit later than that, didn't you?
Well, I started when I was 16. I think Nick was 15.
Yeah,
I was 12 when I really started racing bikes, so it's kind of like the midpoint between you all. What was that initial step into karting for you? How did that come about?
So before that, I actually raced remote control cars. So from when I was like 6 or 7, I was sort of, you know, hacking around in them. And then I started racing those. And so that kind of helped before I came into karting, because I knew, you know, I knew what a race line was. I knew sort of, you know, I had a rough idea of, how it would work. It didn't mean I didn't spin on the first lap of karting, but, you know, it sort of helped with the general principles, I guess, from a young age. So that was helpful. And then, yeah, got into karting 2011.
I mean, we don't see many people, like, take up RC racing, do we? I mean, at one point I even had one, but I was useless at it. But obviously, the most famous one of sort of F1 drivers is Lewis Hamilton. I mean, he started in RC racing, I think. I mean, like you said there, you can take the racing line away from it, but is there anything else, like, obviously, besides more than just the principles of racing lines and, you know, braking and throttle, acceleration, all of that?
I mean, it's sort of a bit similar in terms of, like, the pressure and stuff like that. Obviously, it's a bit of a smaller scale, but when you're 6 or 7, you know, every race is like you're trying to fight for a Formula One world title. So, you know, it's got its own pressures at the time. So I guess that maybe helped in a bit, I guess. But, you know, I was just going out there trying to win everything, and it was usually do pretty good or end up in the wall with my car in a million pieces. So,
not quite as expensive.
Not quite as expensive. You know, when a set of tires is like probably £100 instead of whatever the Pirellis are, 1,000, 2,000, something in between there. You know, it's a little bit nicer on the bank, but I went through my fair share of parts, put it that way.
Did you have to actually race wheel to wheel against each other? So I presume you may have learned a little bit of racecraft, even though it may have been subconscious subconscious back then.
Sort of. I mean, the bigger problem, well, not problem, but the bigger thing in RC cars is, like, with the curbs, you can't really use them per se. Like, you can use them a bit, but it's very easy to use them and then sort of use them as a ramp and roll over and, you know, have to get someone to turn you back onto your wheels and stuff like that. So it was more sort of waiting for people to make mistakes. And, you know, like when I was that young, it was always that kind of thing. And the level, you know, it was a decent level in Australia. It was kind of like national level, but, you know, people were still making mistakes and sort of like turning over and stuff. So it was more just waiting for people to do that rather than actually forcing a move, because 9 times out of 10, that didn't end very well for both of you. You both ended up crashing normally, and particularly racing against like an 8 or 9 year old, it definitely didn't end too well for the other folks very often.
I'm kind of thinking at the moment whether, because I imagine reaction time is quite a big thing in RC racing. So I wonder whether that like helps with going into karting.
I mean, sort of, yeah. Like the RC cars are pretty quick. Like the ones I was racing probably went to like 100, 110 Ks an hour, and they were electric motors. So they went, you know, they had pretty good acceleration as well. And you know, everything's happening pretty quick and stuff like that. So again, being that young probably helped in terms of the reflexes. I don't know if it would have carried over necessarily into karting so much, because it's a very different hand-eye, like it's still hand-eye coordination, I guess, but in a very different sense and much more of a fear factor in karting.
So once you'd finished with the RC cars, you took the plunge into karting. And then how many years or seasons did you do of karting in Australia?
So I did five full years in Australia, so till the end of 2015, I think sort of by 2013 I'd started doing national level races and stuff like that, and then 2016 was when I first moved to Europe. So I raced for Ricky Flynn Motorsport in karting, did the WSK series and European Championships, World Championships and all of that. That was my first foray into Europe in 2016.
because we've had a few drivers now, and we've asked them sort of all the same question, like the likes of Jordan Pepper, Sheldon van der Linde. We've all asked them, what was that transition like coming over to Europe from your native country? So we'll ask you the same one. You know, there's quite a culture difference between Australia and Europe, UK. What was that like? What was your reaction to it?
Sort of mixed reactions. Like, obviously packing up and leaving home at the age of 14 was, you know, not a light decision. My dad came with me for sort of the first 6 or 7 months, so I wasn't completely alone. But, you know, being away from, you know, your mum, and I've got three sisters as well, so being away from all of them and all your mates and stuff like that for such a long time definitely took its toll, I think. And I think looking back on it, we sort of went across and stayed in Europe for like 7 months straight. And I think having that back, you know, any sort of reasonable gap I had, like 2 or 3 weeks, I probably should have tried to get home to have a bit of a normal life. And then also the other big thing that sort of I wish we did a bit different was I was still trying to do schooling online from Australia. So I, you know, when you're a 14-year-old kid and you know, you're living on the other side of the world and you have to do school online instead of actually attending the classes, not much work happens. So I sort of had like 6 or 7 months where I didn't do much and then was going to the racetrack. And then for like 2 or 3 weeks after, between each race, I was like, I should have done this differently. I could have done that better, you know, blah, 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 just overthinking everything. So it was a definite eye opener. And I think, you know, the UK is not super different from Australia besides the weather. the weather's obviously very different. But, you know, same language, a similar kind of food. And, you know, it wasn't a massive shock to the system, I'd say. But yeah, I think just sort of all of those factors made it a bit of a tough transition. And then I started boarding school in September of 2016. So sort of 9 months after I'd first come. And to be honest, that was probably one of the best decisions me and my family ever made, was continuing with school and then sort of having like a normal life in between races, I guess.
Whereabouts did you go to boarding school?
I went to Haileybury. So it was the same school as Cal Mylott. He was there, I think, a couple of years before me. And also Clement Novlak went there at the same time as me. So that was also kind of nice to have at least one person I semi-knew at that point. But yeah, Haileybury was where I went.
Yeah. And then you obviously you mentioned touched on it earlier that when you committed to European racing and karting, you were in Ricky Flynn's stable. And obviously Ricky Flynn's had some pretty decent drivers come through over the years, so kind of look in a way he kind of looks like the Prima of karting, so to speak. I mean, he's had like Lando, Dan's been there, Tictum, Max, I think Futrell's been there, and Ahmed's won European Championship, I think, there as well. So what is he kind of, would you say, kind of a guy that sort of set you up in terms of mindset and commitment to racing and sort of taking it, you know, as serious as you are now?
I think in terms of at the race weekend, definitely it was, you know, very, very much a professional mindset and a big change compared to racing in Australia. Like in Australia, it was kind of, you know, my dad was my mechanic. We'd turn up to the track, you know, if I had a bit of oversteer, change axle, or, you know, move the rear out 5 mil, 10 mil and away you went. Whereas with Rick, you know, that was the first time I'd gone through data analysis and, you know, sort of been actively testing things to do with setup and, you know, not just necessarily, you know, what do I need to go quicker at the time. You know, we're testing things that didn't necessarily work, but just to know what they actually did, which, you know, as I've gone through the ranks, that's definitely something you carry through. So I think it was definitely a beginning. I probably didn't take my fitness and other side of things as seriously as I should have at the time. I was 14 I think in some regards it definitely prepared me for sort of more European racing and going through the single seater ladder. But, you know, at the same time, it's still karting. You're still racing against, you know, 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, and you're all just there having fun in the end. So I'd say sort of half and half.
That's correct. But, I mean, Jake, I don't know if you've had it as well, but I'd never had data in karting. I mean, I'm a bit older than you, both you guys, but I never had it.
Wasn't invented when you were karting, Nick.
All right, bloody hell. Only left 2009, 2010. Jesus.
No, I mean,
nothing like that for me. I just literally turned up, drove. Obviously, I learned my racecraft and whatnot there and how to be fast. But I think the guys nowadays are even more prepared coming into the likes of cars. So my first test in a car, when I got to look at these squiggly lines, I was like, what the hell is this? But obviously you've already had preparation in karting when there's even less pressure and less money involved. It must be quite a cool thing to be able to get used to before you make that kind of step.
Yeah, I think it was definitely, like, it was obviously pretty cool for me at the time being able to go, oh, wow, yeah, okay. Like lap four, I had a big slide and then, you know, look at this line and says, yeah, it says I actually did that. So I think I probably went a bit overboard on it, to be honest. I was like, probably just overanalyzing and overthinking, and that was sort of the main theme of, I think I was just overwhelmed by so many things. I was trying to like look at everything and then find out how to go faster, and then in the end I probably needed to just shut up and drive and just try and go fast, and that probably would have worked a bit better. But it was, I think looking forward now, obviously it was something I'd learned before I stepped into single seaters, so when I saw it in single seaters, obviously now there's a few more squiggly lines to look at, but it was definitely a, you know, first introduction that I didn't have to get used to again once I got into single seaters.
Yeah, and then obviously you went into single seaters, I think not long after that, into, was it British F4? You did a bit in the UAE as well, didn't you? A few races.
Yeah, so I did like two or three weekends in UAE F4. And that was mainly just to, you know, try and gain a bit of racecraft and stuff like that before my first single seater race, because obviously it's a bit different to, you know, being able to overtake everyone pretty much any corner you like on a karting track, whereas in cars we all know it's much more difficult to overtake, and you got to plan everything much more, and even just getting used to having a bigger car around you, and, you know, something that you don't have side pods and plastic side pods, and, you know, you can't just shunt people off. You know, if you run to the back of someone, either you're going over the top of them or you've broken your front wing and your race is over. So that was kind of just to prepare me for that. And then, yeah, went into British F4.
And you went in with Arden, didn't you? I think it was that TRS Arden team at the time. I always remember sort of sporadically watching that year. And I think, was it Jamie Caroline?
Yeah.
That you were racing for the title. I think it was down to the last weekend, was it not?
On points, yes, it went to the last weekend, but I think you could get 75 points in a weekend, and I think he was like 65 ahead or something going into the last weekend, so it was more or less a done deal. But yeah, on if you were to say I took it to the last weekend, then I'll take that.
It must have been cool though, because you know, one thing I actually quite miss about racing mostly in Europe, or pretty much all in Europe outside of Silverstone in the UK, like, I miss racing at Alton Park and Brands Hatch and even Snett. I mean, it's pan flat, but I actually miss it in a weird way. You know, how was that kind of that experience for you, like, especially likes of Alton and Brands Hatch?
Yeah, I mean, the thing was, I hadn't really raced, like, because of my first year in single seaters, I didn't really know any different. Yeah. So for me, they were kind of just, you know, this is what single seater racing is like and what car tracks are like. Obviously, now looking ahead to where I've gone and, you know, racing at places like Spa and Monza and stuff, and then looking back at when I raced at Alton Park and Knockhill and stuff, you go, yeah, okay, yeah, they're pretty different worlds apart, but they were definitely pretty cool tracks. And I think the biggest thing that everyone would say about them is they bit pretty hard when you got it wrong. You know, a lot of the tracks nowadays, you've got a fair bit of runoff to make your mistakes and live to see another day. But, you know, you drop a wheel off at Knockhill or Alton Park or wherever, and you know that you've dropped a wheel, that's for sure. So yeah, it was pretty cool. And like Knockhill was, it definitely is one that sticks in my mind, you know, the undulation, even just the simple things like going on the road trip to Scotland and stuff like that. It sticks in your head, and, you know, flying over the chicane and stuff like that. You know, there's no sort of tracks we race on now that have the same kind of character, I would say. Obviously, you know, Spa's got a lot of character to it, and even Silverstone's an awesome track, but you know, you don't have a 50-second lap where you're flying over chicanes and stuff like that.
It's like you say, it's almost the danger element, fear element in a way, isn't it? That, you know, if you make a mistake, that's it, you're done. There's no track limits issues in these kind of places. I mean, that's
what I call really proper racing.
That's
what I love.
I don't understand why, like, the likes of the FIA and these championships. I mean, if you take Spa, for example, last year, I mean, Spa, you could always run wide a little bit in some corners, like in No Name or even a bit in Puan, let's say, but they started putting all these just concrete runoffs down there. And it ruins it. I can't stand it. I wish almost one day I could take a Formula 3 car around Alton Park just for fun.
Definitely.
But yeah, I mean, pretty much after that, you went straight into European racing again, I think, into Eurocup, I guess. Did you one or two years in that, didn't you? You did two, I'm pretty sure.
Two, yeah.
Yeah, and your first one, I guess, was going straight in with Arden.
Yeah.
How was that first year, sort of experiencing, like you said, we just touched on it a little bit, but these European tracks, a bit more, probably a bit wider, a bit more open. I mean, they're cool in many ways, but obviously they're a bit different. So how did you find that?
It was another transition for sure. You know, racing it at a lot of the tracks was very cool, and especially because it was the first time I'd been there. Like, you know, when you rock up to Monza for the first time, or Spa or Silverstone GP, or, you know, wherever it is, and you've been watching these tracks on TV for the last 5 or 10 years or however, and then you go, yeah, I'm driving on them now, it's an awesome feeling. And then, you know, unfortunately, half of me go, okay, this is a cool track to drive, but I don't know where I'm going to overtake anyone. Or, you know, this would be cool if there was still gravel there or whatever, like you said. And that sort of fear factor was there. But, you know, even Silverstone now with the runoff, it's still an awesome track. And I think it's definitely one of the driver's favorites. Spa, you know, like you said, it's a bit of a shame with the concrete runoffs now. And I still remember our driver's briefing very well from F3 about the track limits controversies. But, yeah, driving on those tracks for the first time was pretty cool as well, I would say.
I love those driver's briefs. Well, I don't, I'm being sarcastic, but those the ones where they say, you know, you can go wide, but don't gain advantage. And you're like, well, so I'm allowed to go wide or am I not, basically?
Like telling a six-year-old kid to, like, giving them an ice cream and telling them not to eat it. It's not going to happen.
Like, you can go wide. We're not necessarily going to delete your lap. It's only if we deem you gain an advantage. Well, like, that's just saying to, like you say, to a racing driver, like, I'm going to try it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't know. It's one of those things, isn't it? But then obviously the next year you switch team, I think, to our race, which is probably, I imagine, the first time you properly experienced a different culture within a race team. Being French, and you come over from obviously Australia, and like you said earlier, it's a bit, you know, in a sort of way this similar to Australia, the UK, and then you go over the UK team all the time through karting and into your first year in Eurocup, and then you switch to a French team. I mean, I've experienced it myself, the difference. How did you find it?
It went pretty well. Like, we won the championship, so I can't say too much bad things, but it was a bit of a shock again in terms of the culture. It wasn't bad at all. You know, I think quite a few French teams sort of get a bit of a, or just teams in general, it seems to be mainly French teams, get a bit of a bad rep sometimes. But I had nothing bad to say about our race. I loved the year. Obviously, helps that we won the championship, but they were super professional, and, you know, I think some people, when they see a French team, sort of, I don't know, think they're a bit snobby, or, you know, here's the car and drive it kind of mentality, and, you know, it's down to you, and, you know, we're going to change the car. But from my experience, it was nothing like that. You know, we were in a brand new car for that year, so we were testing a lot of things and stuff like that. It wasn't, you know, here's the car, drive it, and if you're slow, then it's your fault. Like, that definitely wasn't the case. So I really liked that year, and I still stay in touch with Thibaut and Cyril. So Thibaut was the team manager and Cyril was my engineer. So yeah, I still stay in touch with them. I actually saw them at Imola last weekend or the week before, at the Formula Regional race. So yeah, I loved that year, and the sort of French culture was nice. I'd heard a few bad things, but from my experience, like I said, it was all positive.
I mean, I even had two weekends in 2014 with it was ART junior team then, but obviously it was our race, so with Thibaut and Cyril. I really enjoyed it, but I wonder whether, because I'd had such a bad year for the first four or five races, that I switched team, and or it was like anything was going to feel good. But no, I mean, I did really enjoy working with those guys. I've always found that French teams are quite analytical, data-driven, number-driven. And if you get on with that, and you could be very, let's say, understanding and respectful that it's actually going to help you, if you dive into it, then I don't think there's a big issue. But like you say, there is sometimes cases, I've even had it myself, where they don't necessarily want to change the car to suit, not necessarily to suit you, because if you're going to be good race and driver, you need to be able to adapt. But, you know, naturally we all prefer one type of balance, let's say. But yeah, I mean, if it suits you, and they clearly did in that year, you had a great year. And that, I guess, because that was the Formula Renault Euro Cup, that was the reason why you got signed into the Renault Junior Academy.
Yeah. So that was the prize for winning the championship. And yeah, we didn't have to think about that one too hard, in terms of whether we're going to join the academy or not. So yeah, that was how I got my way in.
And they kind of, I guess they, you know, there's obviously the financial side of it, but, you know, stories I've heard, it varies, and it's not always the case that they help everyone into the best seat possible, like with Prema, like you got. But, you know, they clearly help you and assist you, you know, things like training and sort of advice, and, you know, driving the simulator, I guess, as well. So, I imagine that felt quite cool to kind of have that support and that network of backing.
Yeah, definitely. Like, don't get me wrong, it comes with a bit of added pressure. And, you know, when I first joined the academy, I was kind of like, okay, I've got to, you know, hold my own here. Otherwise, you know, this is an awesome opportunity, and probably the only one I'm going to get in terms of being linked with an F1 team. So I've got to make the most of it and, you know, not stuff it up, basically. But yeah, they've been really, really good. Like you said, help on the financial side, which is great. But yeah, that's the main reason I live in Oxford, because it's 20 minutes away from Enstone, where the F1 factory is. And I go there pretty much every day. I'm here to use the gym and stuff like that, and talk to the engineers and, you know, all that kind of stuff as well. You know, obviously I've got Prema as well that I still talk to a lot. I don't want too many chefs around the pot trying to, tell me what to do and stuff like that. But, you know, every little advice you can get, and, you know, there's no better place to get it from an F1 team. So, they've been really, really good, and it's just awesome to be in the academy, to be honest. That's not trying to big them up at all. It's been really good so far.
I want the seat.
pretty much. Yeah.
Do you find that, like, being in an environment like that really helps you? Because I know we've spoke about it with other people as well, but there's obviously an added pressure being in an F1 team's academy program. But do you find like that added pressure brings the best out of you, or do you feel like, it's actually quite a lot to deal with?
I wouldn't say it's really a lot personally. Like, the way I look at it is, like, me on a personal level, I want to get to F1. And if I'm going to get to F1, then I've got to be beating everyone, regardless of whether they're in an academy or if they're not or whatever. So if I am going to try and get to F1, then, you know, my own expectations are going to have to be higher than, or at least the same, if not higher than what, you know, the academy is setting me as a target. So in that side of things, I wouldn't really say it added any pressure. Obviously, the first year in the academy was very good. And, you know, this year's off to a pretty solid start as well. But yeah, like I said, if I'm trying to get to F1, so I've got to try and beat everyone. And, you know, I'm not going to, even if I beat the other two F2 boys in the academy, if we're 10th, 11th and 12th, then none of us are going to be getting into F1. So I think it's, you know, it's not an added pressure. It's just, I've got more resources now at my disposal to help me achieve my own goals on a personal level. And obviously, you know, with all their support and backing and whatnot, it's in their best interest to help me to get there as well.
And talking, yeah. go on, Nick, what were you going
to
say?
Yeah, I was going to ask about, do you get to speak to the F1 drivers themselves? I mean, I don't know Fernando at all, but I worked with Esteban myself a little bit when he was at Racing Point and knew him from previous teams as well. So do you actually get to bounce off ideas with those guys and try and be a sponge and learn? Because obviously they have huge experience. Esteban, I think, has raced for Prema and won the F3 championship back in the day. So with little tips and tricks and how they go about their daily life, can you sponge off them?
Especially in COVID times, it's pretty difficult, to be honest. Sure. Because like, trying to, you know, keep your bubbles to yourself and blah blah blah, it's pretty tough. But I'd say last year, this year, obviously there hasn't been many chances to speak to them that much, but last year I got to speak to Daniel and Esteban a bit, and then Renault took me to Turkey for the Grand Prix there, I got to, you know, sort of have a good chat with Daniel and Esteban, and not necessarily like tips and tricks and stuff, but even just sort of getting to know who they are. And, you know, obviously it was a race weekend, so I wasn't going to grill them with their, you know, what's your life story and how do you get to F1? And you know, especially for Daniel being Australian, like, I love you, can you sign this? And even Esteban, like you said, being with Prema, it was sort of nice to have that in common and just be able to talk to him about, you know, what Rene used to give him as a nickname and, you know, stupid stuff like that. It's nice to have a bit of a relationship with them, but Renault's really good in terms of Alpine now. I'm still getting used to the name. They're really good in sort of integrating us, especially now that the F2 boys, they're really good at sort of bring us into the ops room on the race weekends and listening into the debriefs and stuff like that. So even if we're not directly talking to the F1 drivers, we're still listening to what they're saying and stuff like that. And they let us stay on for the Pirelli 18-inch test in Bahrain with Fernando and Esteban. So we got to, you know, sit in the debriefs in person and talk to Fernando and Esteban about, you know, what their thoughts on the 18-inch tyres were and stuff like that. So that was really cool. But yeah, it's a bit difficult to get any tips and tricks off them, because all going well, I could be racing them in a couple of years.
Yeah.
So they're not going to give me everything. But also, you know, they're busy with their own stuff. So it's a bit tough.
Yeah, I can understand. But being able to sit in a meeting and stuff like that with Alonso, for example, who is one of the best drivers of my generation for sure, is invaluable and just something you wouldn't get unless you were part of that program. So obviously it's pretty privileged and cool position to be in. I wish I'd have been in the same situation. Maybe I wasn't good enough at the time, but to get the opportunity. But now, you know, if I listen to debriefs and work with these guys with huge experience and say, and working at Aston, look through Vettel's notes, it's just little things on maybe how they explain something or the feedback that they give, which is a slightly different way of explaining it, but better. All those little things make you a better driver for when you have that opportunity to drive the F1 cars in a race situation, which I hope you get the chance to do.
Yeah, definitely. Like, the first debrief I was in with Fernando, and you know, I think Fernando gets a bit of a, bad rep, but tough rep in terms of how demanding he is and tough he is and stuff like that. But you know, he's just, in the debriefs that I've sat in so far, he's just saying what he feels, and you know, there's no filter on it. You know, take that as you will. And you know, some people react to that better than others, but at the end of the day, he's telling everyone exactly what he wants, exactly what he's got, and what he needs. So it was, yeah, very, very cool to listen to him. And even Esteban, you know, he's not exactly a new kid on the block in F1 anymore. And I think also from his time at Mercedes, you know, being sort of, I think he was reserve driver there.
Yeah, I think he was.
You know, I think he's picked up on a few things from Lewis and the drivers there as well. So, you know, I think he's learned off them, and now I'm learning off him. So it's sort of, you know, all trickling down to where I am at the moment. So it's pretty cool to be able to listen to them, definitely.
And before we move on from Alpine, there's a new appointment at the top from the MotoGP world in the former Suzuki boss, Davide Brivio. Have you seen much impact of that yet? And have you had a chance to speak to him, really?
I've met him, yep. So I met him in Bahrain at the first weekend. And yeah, really, really nice guy. Really easy to talk to. Obviously, I think being in Prema and him being Italian helped kick off communications a little bit. But yeah, he seems really good so far. I can't really say anything about what his impact on the team has, because you know, I'm not in the F1 team yet. I'm just in the academy, so I don't know, you know, what he's sort of done for the team yet. But from my impressions, he's a really nice guy and very supportive of the academy, and truly wants to see us do well. You know, from people I've spoken to before and sort of doing a bit of research into him myself, he's pretty keen to bring in. He was sort of a big advocate for young riders in MotoGP.
Yeah, massively.
So sort of hopefully that bodes well for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was really nice guy, and you know, first man there. You know, I think we had an Alpine 1-2-3 in Bahrain race 2, and you know, he was there congratulating all of us and making sure all the, you know, we all got congratulated, and bringing out the other big bosses as well. I think he brought out Alan Prost and stuff. So brilliant. Yeah, he's been really good to be with so far.
I mean, as you said, you know, he really brought some young riders through in GP. He brought, you know, the current world champion Joan Mir up from Moto2 straight into the factory team. And the same, you know, bringing Alex Rins in created a real killer duo last year. And that's continued into this year with Suzuki, and bringing their first title in about 20 years. So, you know, the man did an awesome job. So hopefully he can take that over to F1. But we mentioned earlier about beating everyone to get up the ranks. I've been set, like, boys.
Where that was going straight away.
You know, I've been saying to Jake, Oscar, I've been saying, look, I really want to get a successful F3 driver on here to, like, you know, give his inputs and talk about how, you know, to drive an F3 car properly. What was it like racing him? Come on, tell us everything.
I'm trying to think if we actually had many wheel-to-wheel battles.
No, I mean, Oscar, you would have been too far.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, mate, this is appalling, you know.
I think we had one at Silverstone, maybe.
Yeah.
But besides that, I mean, we didn't crash into each other, so that's probably a good start.
That's probably why on the podcast.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I had no issues with Jake. Pretty sure he didn't have any issues with me, otherwise I probably wouldn't be speaking here at the moment. So yeah, it was all good from my point of view.
Yeah, the only other thing was the drama. I mean, drama's not the right word. Just the palaver around the whole qualifying in Monza.
Yes, that is a very good point. I got a penalty in qualifying for impeding someone, which was questionable. And I'm pretty sure Jake actually was in the stewards against me, but was actually defending me from the stewards. So that was very much appreciated. Didn't help me in the long run.
Yeah, still got the penalty. I was a bit gobsmacked, to be honest, by their reasoning, because we talked a lot about that before that weekend. I mean, we saw it the year before in Monza in F3 and then even F1 quali. Everyone's searching for the toe, and obviously the driver's briefing comes around and they don't really talk like tough on it. And I think someone raised the point, rightly so, that it comes from whoever's at the front of the queue. So there needs to be a kind of gentleman's, that in itself is where the problem lies, because you're not going to get a gentleman's agreement that is adhered to by a racing driver, where the person
in the F3 drivers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're all selfish. We're all fighting for our own careers anyway, which I get. But in that case, it wasn't your fault, really. I mean, there was if it wasn't you that blocked me, because I think I'd actually done two purples or something like that. I was on a good lap. And then I came across you first, but it was actually you were trying to get out of my way, and I would have been blocked by another 10 cars who were, 100 yards up the road. So it's...
Yeah, this stuff's been happening. It was the same arguments in 2010. When did I do it? GP3. 2011, the same arguments. Yeah, Always just waiting for someone. And at the time, we had even more of a tow because we had the less powerful turbo engines with different aero package. So the tow you could get around there was massive. And it would just never change, simply. Particularly in Formula 3 when you need it. In F2, you could probably still do the pole lap on your own if you get a really good run, but not in F3.
Well, it's because we've got 30 cars now as well. It makes it just so much worse. The reason they give is they make an argument saying, oh, you know, we give you 30 minutes and you all arrive on the same track at the same time, like almost saying, like, we need you to spread out. It's like, well, why do you think that is, really? You know, we'll calculate on a computer exactly when we need to go out to do the lap at the last moment. And you think someone in their truck's going to say, oh, you know what, we're not going to do that today. It would be nice to Prema and HWA and let them all do it last.
Yeah, it's some of the stewarding throughout the whole year, to be honest, was questionable at best, and I'll leave it at that, I think.
But it always is, particularly from a racing driver's point of view, you always disagree with something. I know they're trying to do their job, but I'm not going to go in too hard on them either, because I'm still wanting to win some races without getting penalties. But some of their guys or girls that I had during my junior career or single-seater career as well, that I found that I had the biggest problem with the people that had never raced themselves, because they don't know what it's like. And all stewards should always have that person at least in the room with them to bounce off, that they can, have a chat with and say, well, what would this situation actually be like, instead of giving someone a penalty just because they think it's wrong, not necessarily knowing themselves.
So I think, we had the same problem in World Supersport 300, where you just get basically like a queue of bikes into the last corner, and everyone like kind of looking over their shoulder, thinking, who's going to be the first to blink and kind of get in the wind. But they kept pulling us in, and basically, in the end, they came up with something like, right, if you're on track, you have to be within, it's like 107% or 110% of your sector times.
Mm.
So if you're slowing down in a sector, they'll really see it.
Yeah.
However, how much difference do you think that made?
Naffle.
They didn't follow it.
Big zero. But yeah.
The problem is, if too many people do it as well, they don't want to be seen to give. Mind you, actually, I was about to say they don't want to be seen to give the whole grid a penalty, but actually in F3, they seem to give basically half the grid a penalty, especially in 2019. I think those 16, 17 guys out of first got a penalty.
I think I remember speaking to someone about that 2019 qualifying, and I was texting them at like 1 a.m. and
you're still insured.
Yeah, and I was like, don't you have a race in like 8 hours or something? And he's like, yeah, I built the track, I'm going to the stewards room in like 10 minutes. So they was pretty amazed at that.
They called every team in one by one for like, I think that each team had a 10-minute slot to argue, basically. But what do you think happened? Everyone ended up having half an hour. So I was lucky. We were second after ART, I think, or something like that. But yeah, some teams were really unfortunate. But obviously, away from all that stuff, I mean, I'm sure Alex is chomping at the bit to get his point in anyway. But obviously, you had a good year. So how was it joining, obviously, Prema the first time, delivering on that sort of necessity of the championship, I guess, with what Alpine or Renault at the time was probably asking of you?
Yeah, it was like you said, a really good year. I think joining Prema, you know, there's, I don't want to say a mountain, but a pretty big hill of expectation on you, regardless of whether you're a rookie or not. And, you know, I knew that if I was in front of Logan and Fred, who are my teammates, then I was probably going to be there or thereabouts in the championship, which is what happened in the end. But yeah, I mean, there wasn't really any pressure to win the title from anyone, really. Obviously, I would have liked to do that, and even I thought that was a bit ambitious, particularly at the beginning of the year. But I think that kind of went away after the first race. So yeah, it was a good year, and obviously being at Prema was the right choice. We had a few options to go with, but yeah, Prema was clearly the correct choice in the end.
Did you have a chance to go to HWA?
I'll let you pick that one out. So
no, we'll leave that one for the day.
How many Prema drivers have we had on now, boys?
Callum, Marcus. I mean, can we say Callum?
Well, you've said it now, haven't you?
Yeah, I've said it now, yeah. So, Callum, Marcus.
I swear there was another.
Ben Barney, he nearly drove for them. So
yeah, he just did some tests, didn't he?
Yeah. But, I mean, anyway, the guys that we've all spoke to have all basically just said it's just a very good atmosphere. I mean, obviously, the car's quick. But they, you know, I think the atmosphere seems to be the point that I take away from it, that they make you understand what you need to do, but also believe that you can do it.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, but it's even just a bigger atmosphere than that. Like, it's they're a big team. Like, there is an F4 from the regional, F3 and F2. So there's a lot of people there and a lot of staff, a lot of drivers. And they're really good in sort of like creating this family atmosphere and, you know, getting all the drivers together and getting to know each other. You know, I think the Prema media videos are probably pretty famous in the junior single seater ranks, and, you know, sort of doing all those media days together and having fun is actually a really good way of, you know, particularly in your, you know, with your teammates and stuff, it sort of breaks the ice and gets rid of any, you know, any conflict or
before you go and crash on track.
Yeah, like my teammates did last year.
Yeah.
But yeah, just the whole, you know, even away from the track, that side of things is really good. And then when you're at the track, you know, there's obviously the element of expectation, but, you know, they take everything into consideration and, you know, it's not the end of the world if you don't do a perfect job. And, you know, there's an element of understanding and compassion and stuff. And at the end of the day, it is a family-owned business. Like, Rene's dad, Angelo, started Prema whenever he started it, and Rene is continuing it, and his wife, Angelina, is sort of, you know, second in charge. And it's just a really good family atmosphere and stuff like that. And, you know, from F3 and F2, it's Guillaume Capietto, who's sort of technical director across those, who came from ART. So going back to the sort of French transition we had before, it's, you know, whilst Prema is an Italian team, sort of the engineering side of thing and technical side of things is very much French. So, you know, it's very analytical, and you've got the Italian side of things, which is very passionate, and it's just a good combination, really. And yeah, I'm pretty happy that I'm staying for a second year in F2 this year.
Can I imagine? But actually, like you say, people do give the French teams maybe a bit of bad rap from the UK side, but I actually completely disagree, because my engineer was a guy called Yann Cordero, who actually runs...
He's in F2, he ran George...
Lungard, that's who he runs now. Yeah. Actually, he only texted me the other day, but I forgot the driver that he ran. But he literally taught me how to drive a single seater, as in from an engineering point of view. And I had been really quite the opposite of being very analytical. I just tried to drive off feel and what I thought I should do early in my 2 litre Renault career. And he came in and actually completely taught me how to drive. And then I could develop to actually become a better racing driver. So the French side of being very, very strict on how you should drive, you don't have to drive like that. But if you are able to master what they are telling you to do, I feel that it does create some really fantastic drivers. Looking at, you know, all these people that have driven, you know, you've got your Ocons, I mean, in Prema, you had Rosenquist one in there. I'm talking older names because I'm an old fart now. well, you know, all these guys, Roberto Meri, these people that have come in and been very, very successful with Prema or a French team in general, just because I think that they really drill into how you should drive from a basics point of view.
I've actually just remembered and thought that since 2016, I've had a French engineer every year.
Yeah.
In DAMS, in high tech, in ART, and then in HWA for 2 years. So I must love it.
Yeah. I can't remember who it was. I'll put it out there. I went to ART last year to talk to them about F3. No, not last year, the year before, going into F3. And Seb actually pointed out to me that I think the technical director of High Tech, Prema, ART obviously, and HWA were all previous ART engineers, which is pretty, you know, remarkable stat. Obviously, a bit better that Prema sort of managed to beat their own, but it's pretty crazy stat that, you know, sort of those four, arguably the four quickest teams apart from Trident, I would say, in F3. Have all sort of stemmed from, you know, a French engineering background and an ART background.
Exactly. Yeah,
definitely. And the guy that actually went over, I don't know his name, I've forgotten it. I know exactly what it looks like, but he ran Hamilton in GP2. That's where...
Guillaume.
Yeah.
Is he still at ART or Prema now?
I think he's moved to Prema now.
Yeah, then it's Guillaume.
So he he moved from ART quite early on when Prema started to get good, funnily enough.
I think I think when Stoffel Van Dorn won GP2, I think after that year he moved, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Yeah, so he moved for 2016, so when Gasly raced at Prema.
That was moved. I mean, just quickly before we start to sort of wrap it up, I guess. I want to touch on the fact that obviously after winning the championship, I guess it was a prize, but you got your first taste of F1 machinery. I bet that was pretty cool, even just from a point of, you know, waking up, going into the truck, putting the suit on, and then the shock of probably putting the foot on the throttle. How was that?
That was just awesome. You know, it's every racing driver's dream to drive an F1 car. So pretty privileged and lucky to sort of, you know, add that to the list of cars I've driven now. I knew if I won the championship, then I had that prize, if you want to call it that. Just everything about it was super cool. You know, I think the biggest thing for me was the braking. We were running semi-safe on the engine side of things. You know, don't get me wrong, we're still going pretty quick on the straights, but the biggest thing for me was the braking. I think, you know, like 5.5G or something under brakes. And, you know, Bahrain's a pretty big stop into turn one. So I think the first time I hit the brakes, my head just like went straight to the steering wheel and had to, you know, that was the first time I had to think about holding my head up, hitting the brakes, you know, cornering. It's pretty normal, but yeah, that was the first time I'd had to do that. And coming from the F3 car, going from steel brakes to carbon brakes, you know, that was again a big part of why braking was such a big thing. But yeah, it was just an awesome day, and yeah, that's all I can really say about it. It's just awesome.
I mean, Renault and Alpine do pretty good job, I think, of putting young drivers in the car. I mean, I think Christian seems to be driving it every month. I seem to see him all the time in it every time I open Instagram. But that 17 car, I think it is. But yeah, I think they do a really good job of trying to prepare you guys for hopefully jumping into the seat. I mean, has anyone actually gone through the academy yet into F1?
Esteban, no. Kind of, no, because yeah, it was gravity, and then I know he went away, but then it's come back.
But I guess it's a big goal of theirs, surely, to get somebody in from the academy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what, you know, obviously I'm not the one making the decisions, but obviously with Davide's sort of previous history in bringing young riders up at Suzuki and now joining the F1 team, you know, hopefully bring sort of a similar mentality here. Mm. And, you know, the academy wouldn't exist if they, you know, weren't trying to get one of the academy drivers into F1. You know, it's been a fair few years now where, you know, they haven't had a driver in F1 from the academy, but, you know, if that wasn't their goal, then it would have been wrapped up by now. So you know, from what I believe, it's still definitely their goal to get someone from the academy into F1. And, you know, I think they prove that consistently with all the sort of teaching they're giving us in terms of engineering and you know, supporting us financially and giving us F1 tests. You know, if they didn't truly believe in us and trying to get us into F1, then we wouldn't be getting any of that. So, yeah, I think they're definitely still pushing to get someone into F1 from the academy.
Mm, for sure. And, you know, you've had a great start to the 2021 season in F2. What's, you know, and we've had you've said successful test in Barcelona. What's the outlook for the rest of the season? Like, just absolutely keep learning the car or just push on for those wins more and more?
I think my sort of mindset's definitely changed from prior to Bahrain. I think I kind of went into Bahrain sort of, you know, it's going to be a tough year. F2 is a big step up. And then, you know, the sort of first weekend I had, don't get me wrong, I was still very much learning a lot of things on the fly. But, you know, being able to get a win whilst still sort of learning and getting used to everything, I think that, you know, sort of just proves the potential we've got as a team driver together. And, you know, I think we can well and truly be in the championship hunt. You know, I'm trying to, like I said, I'm trying to get to F1. I'd prefer to do it as quickly as possible. And, you know, if I can only do 1 year in F2, then get to F1, then, you know, that's only gonna help my momentum. So yeah, I'm definitely got my eyes on the championship now.
Yeah, you've got to have it on the championship after that first weekend, mate. Trust me. You've joined some good company there, because if I remember correctly, Stoffel won on his first weekend. I think Lando did as well, both that have made it straight into Formula One the year after. So yeah, you've definitely started as you mean to go on, and yeah, we wish you the best of luck for that. We're now going to wrap up. So thank you very much for coming on, obviously. And thank you for everyone for listening here at the HYM podcast. Make sure you go over to all Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, follow Oscar, obviously, on his social media, which is at Oscar Piastri, I think on all handles. And obviously come back also to the HYM podcast tomorrow morning when we all have our new release. This isn't going live, so we actually have already heard it. But obviously every Wednesday for those new releases. Make sure you also like and subscribe, as always, and get in the comments. Any questions will always be asked to our future guests. So, nice. Yeah, then we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for coming on again, Oscar. Really appreciate it.
No worries, guys. Thanks for having me, boys. Enjoy it.